were corralling a herd of runnerless rocking horses, painted up as if they had cantered down from the Siberian steppes. Sally Ann was repopulating the Princess Isle, decimated in last night's deluge, while John Horwood, the Emporium caretaker, was patching holes in the floorboards caused by some boy's pitched battle. Even the new girl, the one who had arrived on opening night and barely spoken a word ever since, was emerging from the storerooms, heaving a sled spilling over with fresh stock. Emil fingered the Imperial Capitan in his pocket. It occurred to him that there was only one person he really wanted to show, and that was the one person who hadn't even deigned to get out of bed. Caspar. Emil took the shortcut to the Godman's quarters, high in the Emporium eaves. Mrs. Horning was serving Papa Jack his salt fish for breakfast, but Emil's brother Caspar was nowhere to be found. His bed had the air of one that had not been slept in for days, its covers heaped high in a kind of vagabond's nest. Mrs. Horning had long since forsaken cleaning the Godman's boys' rooms on account of the clockwork spiders she had once caught nesting there. Caspar's notebook was open at the side of his bed, but Emil was proud enough to resist peeking inside. Whatever designs had been scribbled here were Caspar's alone, and he had no desire to betray him. When the Emporium one day belonged to Emil, he wanted the victory to be clean. There was another place his brother would be, and sure enough, there he was, bent over the work table in the attic workshop above their father's own. Bigger than Emil's only because they had once shared it. Emil had left 3 winters ago and built a workshop of his own, a private place where their secrets need not be shared. It was cluttered with more debris than Emil thought possible. A disorderly workshop, Emil knew, meant a disorderly mind. He allowed himself the slightest of all smiles. Caspar was at the hearth in the hourglass's end, though no fire had been kindled in the grate. 1 year Emil senior, he had shed the poppy fat both boys had once had, and which Emil's body stubbornly refused to lose, and crouched over his work table with the same intensity with which Emil had worked on his soldiers. His hair was swept back in an ostentatious peak, revealing eyes more shrill and blue than Emil's, and a nose that might have befitted a Roman legionnaire. Emil saw, with a sinking feeling, that the Imperial Capitan had features almost wholly the same, and the thought brought him great displeasure. Nevertheless, "Caspar," he called out, "I've something to... Wait until you... 1 moment, little brother, I've something to show you." On the worktop in front of Caspar sat a simple glass jar, etched in sigils and lines. Caspar took a small candle from the mantel on top of the hearth, struck a match against the wick and dropped it into the jar. Moments later, he screwed the lid shut and reclined as the dark workshop walls turned into a theatre of shadows and lights. The walls were a kaleidoscope, animals and men picked out in different gradations of shadow, and all of them spinning a synchronized arabesque. A princess appeared, blew a kiss at Emil and vanished in a whirlwind of dancing girls. An armada of galleons manifested, and beneath them there arose a great whale, which devoured each ship in turn. Stickmen sailors tossed themselves overboard, lost to the shadowy sea. "A nightlight," Caspar exclaimed, "for boys and girls too excitable to go to sleep. Can you imagine it, Emil? Your nursemaid comes, reads you some dullest-ditch water story, probably with a nice moral at its end, and expects you to roll over and sleep, but bang! They close the door. You light your light, and..." Emil barely heard the rest. On the walls, a swarm of fairies were dancing in pirouette as a vast, fire-breathing serpent struggled to fight them off. A knight on a fierce destrier dropped his lance and cantered in, skewering the dreaded beast in the same moment that his horse revealed itself as Pegasus, spread its wings and took flight. In the jar, the candle guttered and died. The shadow spell vanished, leaving behind only naked walls and a familiar, obliterated feeling in Emil's stomach. He had been fingering the Imperial Capitan all the while, but now he slipped it back into his pocket. "Well, what was it you wanted to show me, little brother?" Caspar had kicked back a satisfied grin on his face. "I'll show you a fistful of my knuckles if you aren't on the shop floor when those doors open. You've had all summer for trying new things, Caspar. It isn't fair to shirk all the hard work. Casper skipped through the detritus of the workshop floor and put an arm around his brother. You're being a scoundrel. Don't you think it took hard work, my nightlight? Emil was about to reply when the workshop door blew open, as if under the fist of a blizzard, and there hunched their father. The great bear had to stoop to come into the workshop, for it had been built to the design of a 12-year-old boy. "Papa!" Casper exclaimed, always swift to the attack. "Might I?" In a second he had lit a new candle in the jar. This time the shadow dance was different. Emil tried to resist his delight as a damsel in distress fled from the wolf pack of a spidery forest, as a castle made out of clouds descended from on high, as mermaids danced and swam in formation. All the while, Papa Jack's glacial eyes flitted between the shadow dance and Emil. Then, when the performance was in full flight, he tramped across the workshop, took Casper's place at the worktop, and snuffed the candlelight. A moment later, he was pressing a minuscule blade to the jar. A magnifying glass was in his eye, and he was scratching particles away, opening up infinitesimal chasms, prompting a billion tiny fractures in the glass. When he was done, he set the jar back down, relit the candle, and fastened the lid. Fireworks exploded across the walls. What started as shadows turned into blooms of glittering colour. The fairies that fought with the dragons fluttered wings of silver, cyan, and gold. The dragon's scales were emerald green, and the Pegasus was white as the world's most dazzling pearl. Unicorns cantered across rolling dells. Castles sat stark while briars rose up around them, burst open with ruby-red roses, and withered away again. A rainbow burst out of the masonry and cascaded from one wall to the next, erupting in gold in every place that it landed. Papa Jack picked himself up. "I don't want you two fighting today. There's an example needs setting. It's well understood." Then he pressed a piece of parchment into Emil's hands and disappeared. Emil made as if to follow, but Casper remained still. "Yours was magical, Casper. It was." "More magical than my soldiers," thought Emil, though he said not a word. "How does he do it?" "If I knew that," thought Emil, "I'd be doing it too. And then the Emporium would come to me." Casper raised his hand as if to swat the jar onto the floor. But something, perhaps his sense of wonder, perhaps his ambition, stayed his hand. "Come on, little brother," he said. "Haven't we got work to do?" And that was how another day at Papa Jack's Emporium began. The paper Papa Jack had passed to them was a list of chores only the Godman brothers were entrusted to undertake. The reindeer, which had starred in the opening night extravaganza, had wandered into one of the storerooms and set to grazing on the bales of felt warehoused there. Their motors needed neutering, for they were literally eating the winter's profits. By the time that was done, the shop was open, the first customers swarming the aisles. Emil tramped, and Casper sashayed, to the atrium at the centre of the aisles and set to work on the diorama waiting there. An hour later, they were still hard at work, grappling after a nuance that always seemed out of reach. While Emil worked on the landscape of papier-mâché and clay, Casper crouched between the jaws of the two enormous bears, positioning their teeth to provide just the right amount of horror. Fear had to be leavened by joy, or a toy had no appeal at all. It was an operation that was taking the brothers much longer than it ought, because Casper kept rising onto his haunches to peer through the stacks at the new girl working in the alcove of paper trees. There was something about her that kept drawing his eye, though Emil would have pointed out that every new girl drew Casper's eye. It was one of the many things that exasperated him about his brother. "She's called Kathy. Kathy Ray. There's something about her." Casper slid the final tooth into place. Perhaps the effect caught even him off guard, for suddenly he could feel the moist breath of the bear across his cheek, and all the terror that came with it. That was when he knew he had the diorama just right. That was the kind of thrill little boys would want. "How long has it been since she came?"
2 weeks, said Emil. 3?
"And you're only just telling me now?" "Casper, I'm really not telling you a thing." Emil stared. This girl, this Kathy Ray, was filling shelves with more Emporium instant trees. They were a new toy for this winter, and it pained him to remember that they were one of Casper's inventions. Their papa hadn't even seen any need to tweak them himself, and this pained him most of all. The toy over which Emile had spent all summer labouring, the pipe cleaner birds who, released from their nests, would explode forth and find roosts on top of cupboards and bedposts and picture rails, were selling in pitiful numbers compared to the trees. When customers bought them at all, it was only so that they had something to roost in one of Casper Scott's pines.
"Do we know where she came from?"
"She answered one of Papa's adverts." "So do they all," sighed Casper, and picking himself up, he vaulted the first black bear and took off through the aisles. Emile watched him go. There was a time when he used to think, "When I'm Casper's age, I'll be just like him. I'll be making the toys they all clamour for. And I'll be vaulting bears. I'll be talking to the shop girls whenever Papa's looking the other way." But the thing he'd been thinking recently was, "I'm already Casper's age. I'm the age he was last year. And last year I was the age he was the year before that." That was the fate of being a younger brother. Sometimes he wished there was some way he might catch up, overtake him somehow. If only for a moment, Casper might have been the one looking up to him, cooing over the toys he had made, sloping off to his workshop at night and thinking, no, dreaming, that one day he'd be as close to achieving the feats their papa could in his most marvellous toys. But that was a terrible thing to think about his own flesh and blood. He and Casper had played in these halls for so many years, built labyrinthine dens together, spent whole weeks running wild with the rocking horses. There was not a memory in Emile's head in which Casper did not sit at his left-hand side. So why was it that, in recent seasons, things had started to feel so strained? He thought, suddenly, of the feat of magic in the workshop above. How Casper's nightlight had cast those enchantments, even before their papa's tinkering had magnified it a thousandfold. There was a time only their father was capable of such things. He might have brooded further, but small hands were tugging at his sleeve, and when he looked down there was a girl, bearing up one of his father's Russian horses, and begging him to show her how to make it canter. He settled down, cross-legged, right there in the middle of the aisle. Let Casper talk to the shop girls all he wanted. Let him chase real magic. Let him devise the most fanciful, flamboyant toys his imagination would allow. Emile, or so he told himself, needed nothing of that. He set the little horse to canter, and placed by its side the Imperial Capitan. Once wound up, the Capitan marched off to war at the side of his trusty steed. The little girl beamed and clapped her hands at their dainty movements, and out of the aisles poured more boys, more girls, all desperate to see. Yes, let Casper dream up anything he cared to dream. This was where the true joy of the Emporium existed. In the ordinary magic of children at play. Kathy was concentrating so deeply on building her pyramid of boxed-up trees that she did not notice Casper's approach. It was the middle of the afternoon, and across the Emporium the shopkeeps were tending to their aisles. 17 days had passed since the night she stepped through the Emporium doors. There had been much to learn, and had it not been for the moments when nausea got the better of her, and she had to bolt for a secluded corner or washroom, those first Emporium days might have passed in a blur. As it was, fixing her mind and trying to commit all its many corners to memory gave Kathy a focus that helped her ride each crest and wave. It was important to do a good job. She made it her litany as she set about her tasks. If we do a good job, they'll want us to stay, even after Christmas. That seemed important. Get to Christmas, get to New Year, and things could begin afresh. By then they'd like her. By then she'd be indispensable. She'd done it before. That summer in the raspberry fields, they'd begged her to come back next season, said she did the work of 10 other girls, and didn't even shovel the berries into her face all day as well. We'll make it so this place can't go on without us, little thing. She placed another box on the shelf. This one, or so the simple stenciling declared, was a black larch. The one she was placing on top of it was a Bosnian pine. Most of the trees in the pyramid were hawthorn and horse chestnut, and a separate stack were simple firs, of the kind draped in tinsel outside the emporium doors. People had been buying them instead of Christmas trees. There had even been a letter from the Forestry Commission instructing them to desist. Each box had a tiny image etched into it with a burnt match head, and under that were the words, "Warning, do not shake." "Watch how you go with those. Open them wrong and they'll put down roots." She turned. There, propped against a pillar, was the boy they called Casper. She had seen him often enough, striding across the shop floor with his black hair flowing behind him, dressed in a waistcoat more ostentatious than she had ever seen on a boy his age. Like his brother Emil, he had eyes of the shrillest blue, but Casper was lean and angular where his brother was given to fat. The way he held himself, he almost seemed to be reclining, even while he stood upright. Sally Ann, who lodged in a room in the same attic as Kathy, and had been with the Emporium every winter since opening night, said he was the one you had to watch out for. His tongue was loose, but his hands were looser. "And him," she said, "just 19 years of age." "They're mine, don't you know?" He said it with the same pride Kathy's sister had when she was but 2 and 3 years old. Every last thing, be it a toy, a spoon, a seashell, had been mine, mine, mine. "These trees? You wouldn't think it, but that's 3 months of my life you're putting on those shelves. Papa said it's as good as any toy he ever made, and he wouldn't say that lightly." At this point, a dog of cotton wadding and patchwork paws crossed the mouth of the alcove, stopped at one of the paper trees to cock a leg, and drifted on. Kathy followed it with her eyes, then looked at Casper as if to say, "As good as that." But Casper was not deterred. "It really is a marvel of engineering. Shall I show you?" It was on the tip of her tongue to excuse herself, but Casper was already lifting a boxed-up black larch from the pyramid and turning it in his hands. "You see, it's all about perspective. You can do the most extraordinary things if you keep the perspective of a child. That's how our papa is training us, to never lose that perspective. To make a toy, you've got to burrow into that little part of you that never stopped being a boy. Because, hidden down there, are all the ideas you would have had if only you'd never grown up." Kathy had not lived such a sheltered life that she had not been buttered up by a boy before. Boys talked to Lizzie all of the time, but there had been moments when it had been Kathy forced to listen to some simpleton prattle on about how his father was getting a motor car, or the crabs he'd hauled in from the traps that morning. She looked at Casper with the same glassy expression as she had with those boys, but she was ashamed to admit there was a little corner of her that wanted him to go on. The idea that one of the paper trees decorating the alcove could spring from a box so small seemed absurd. She looked up at one now. The display was ringed by ewes of crepe paper and corrugated card, a hazel tree with catkins of newspaper curls. Even the smallest of them stood twice as tall as Kathy. The biggest, whose canopy stretched across the rest, reached as far as the gallery above, its branches rimed in hoarfrost of confetti. I don't know where the idea of trees and boxes came from. Only I can still remember the little village where we Godmans used to live, and how big the trees seemed there. I was barely a boy when we left, but those images always stayed with me. And, at the end of the day, that's what toys do, isn't it? They take you back there, where a part of you always remains. And if I knew, if I could only fix that memory in my mind, I could make the paper do anything I desired. Well, it took me 1,001 attempts to make it work. One wrong fold, you see, and the magic just collapses. Some of the early ones opened up into great shredded nests. One became this gnarled archway of branches and bones. It looked just like a ruined temple. But then, he had been toying with a boxed-up black larch all along, and now he cast it at the ground. Where it hit the hard emporium floor, the varnished box cracked. As soon as the seal was open, whatever forces pinned the tree within grew frenzied and wild. The box whirled on the spot like a spinning top as the paper fought to break free. Then it erupted forth. The box stopped dead, anchoring the paper as it tore upwards. In fits and bursts of unfolding, the trunk revolved and filled out, low boughs sprang outwards, with yet more branches and twigs unfolding from them, and a myriad of brown paper leaves unfurled at their ends. Higher up, the pressure exploded, and out rolled a canopy of interlocking branches and vines, a bird's nest of shredded paper. From a hole in the trunk, the stenciled eyes of an owl gazed watchfully out. All of this had happened in seconds. But for long minutes afterwards, the tremors worked in the tree, and all of its details fell into place. The sound of the paper leaves settling was like the rustling of an autumn wind, even though the Emporium was already in the grip of deepest winter. "It's magical," breathed Kathy. "Would that it were," Caspar replied, gazing into the branches above. "But some things aren't magic at all. Some things are only mathematics." He stopped. "Kathy, I have to apologize. Ordinarily, when new shop hands enlist, I'm the first to welcome them. But you must understand, the night you arrived, it was opening night," finished Kathy. "And you arrived not a moment too soon. We're understaffed this year, as every year. We never know how busy things are going to..." A cry went up somewhere on the Emporium floor. Caspar cut short whatever he was about to say and whirled around, just in time to see two boys hurtling out of the aisle, their faces contorted in terror. Immediately he knew what he had done. The bears between the bookshelves, they had been too real. He had aligned the eyes and teeth too well, taken his work too far again. It was not the first time. Probably one of those boys had dared to put his hand in the bear's mouth, and when he had felt the deep rumble from inside its belly, seen the gleeful malevolence sparkling in its eyes. It was all make-believe, but to boys that didn't matter. Once his father found out, the lecturing would last long into the night. Until Caspar knew what he was doing, until he properly knew his craft, he should contain himself. Things could go dramatically wrong with a toy ill-made, games turned sour on an instant. No doubt Emile would watch gleefully from the corner of their quarters, because any black mark against Caspar was a golden star for Emile. Caspar held up his hands. The boys were rampaging toward him, looking desperately for a place to hide. Some of the shoppers had noticed the commotion now. All eyes along the aisle revolved until they stared into the copse of paper trees. Clawing at each other to get ahead, the boys scrambled into the alcove. As they breached the first line of trees, Kathy felt Caspar's hand close over her own. Then he was wrenching her out of their path. Not a moment later, the boys came cartwheeling past, no longer in control of their own arms and legs. Tangled together, they plunged headlong into the pyramid of boxes. Caspar's hand was like a claw over Kathy's own. She had been trying to tease hers away. This is what boys always did. But now he was straining in the other direction. And when she caught his eyes, they too were open in horror. Only, unlike the boys spread-eagled in the boxes, this horror was tinged with glee. "Run," he mouthed. It took Kathy too long to understand what he meant. By then, the first paper tree was already sprouting. Beneath the prostrate boys, one of the boxes had started to unravel. Paper burst upwards like a geyser, forceful enough to send one boy flying and carry the other up high on a tide of unfolding boughs. Other boxes, their seals already broken, were pulsing as the paper tried to force its way into the light. More had been snagged in the branches of the first tree as it rocketed upwards. But when that tree's growth suddenly stopped, they continued their flight, arcing up past the galleries and into the Emporium dome, where one of the serpents of fabric and lace looped the loop to avoid being hit. Through the branches, still budding newsprint leaves, Caspar saw the flying boxes open. One tree was exploding mid-flight, uncertain which way was down. It became an orb of latticed branches before crashing to earth somewhere among the dolls' houses of the neighbouring aisle. Other boxes remained intact as they flew. They seemed to hang in the air, if only to tease, but in a second they would come down like hailstones. "This way!" cried Caspar. "New girl, now!" He took her by the hand and darted along the aisle. Behind them, one of the boxes crashed down, and seconds later, a Douglas fir erupted. Up ahead, a row of hawthorns ascended, battling against each other as they curled into the vault above the aisles. Caspar steered her left, heard the panicked cries as other shoppers ditched their baskets and fled for the entrance. Somewhere, The patchwork dog was setting up the kind of bark only it could, with a sound like wet laundry. Cathy risked a glance upwards. Boxes were raining down. One had lodged in the rails of the gallery above, and the rowan tree that had sprouted out was teetering, ready to tumble. Instinctively she cowered. That was when she felt Casper's arm about her shoulder. "Here!" he cried, and steered her into a dead end of an aisle. At its apex sat a Wendy house, ringed with a perfect picket fence. Casper was harrying her towards it when one of the boxes landed at her feet. She reeled back, just in time to feel the rush of paper leaves roaring across her face. Casper put his arms around her, pirouetting through the branches of yet more trees springing up around them. To Cathy, the emporium was a whirlwind of whites and yellows, crepe paper and card. Half-blind, she let Casper usher her over the picket fence and in through the Wendy House door. For the first time, the world felt still. Casper still had his arms around her, but now she tore herself out of the embrace. She was ready to barrack him, but the pained expression on his face made her pause. That was when she saw where she was standing. Inside the Wendy House, what had promised to be a cramped corner revealed itself to be a living room of preposterous size. Three armchairs gathered around an open hearth, and in between them was a table with board games piled high. There was a shelf full of books and a deep pile rug, and in the corner a basket in which a toy tiger lounged. As they had approached, the Wendy house had barely reached the line of her shoulder. She closed her eyes, but they had not been deceiving her. Inside, the room was big enough to perform a cartwheel. And she would have done exactly that if only her insides had not been cartwheeling of her own accord all morning. She stretched a hand upwards, but her fingers could not even grace the rafters overhead. She was about to step outside and check the veracity of her own vision, but Casper reached out for her again. Not yet. Outside, the emporium floor was groaning as the new trees settled. Cathy and Casper gazed out across the paper forest. Some enterprising customer had opened a box of Emile's pipe cleaner birds, and they were now fluttering up high, their wings spinning vainly as they searched for a roost. "It will be safe soon," said Casper. "Just wait to make sure they haven't..." The words had barely left his lips when there was a rustling in the boughs of the nearest tree, and from its uppermost branches another varnished box crashed down, fracturing in front of the Wendy House door. Casper staggered back, taking Cathy with him, just as the tree exploded upwards, bulbous trunk and overhanging branches blocking their view. Moments later, when the tree was fully grown, Casper picked himself up and ran his hands across the bark. There was no way through. Half of him was already counting the cost of putting this right, imagining the grave look on his father's face. But the other half was grinning inanely, overjoyed to behold this wonderland his toys had made. The customers who had seen this, those without concussions at any rate, would make sure this story was told for Christmases to come. There would be a rush on Emporium Instant Trees tomorrow. This he could say with every inch of merchant's instinct that lay within him. "Papa," he would say when the old man began his rebuke, "don't you see what I've done? I've done better than make us a fortune. I've made us a spectacle. My toys, they'll outsell Emile's soldiers for certain." He was about to impart all this to the new girl, yet, when he looked around, she was still agape, exploring every recess of the Wendy house, running her fingers over every surface as if to make certain it was real. "What is this place?" "This, Miss Ray, is my papa's pride and joy. He loves it so much he can't bear to sell it. So we keep it just for show. Last Christmas, a man waltzed in here with a Gladstone bag stuffed full of pound notes, but Papa wouldn't even come out of his workshop to see him. I had to send him away with a flea in his ear." "But how?" It pained Casper to admit that he did not yet fully comprehend what his father had done to stretch out the space inside the playhouse. "Papa does things. Emile or I will make a toy, and along comes Papa, and... he's better, don't you see? The things he does, why, there are toys. And then there are Papa Jack's toys. And this Wendy house, well, I'll get to the truth of the matter soon enough. Didn't you ever have a lair when you were small? Somewhere secret only you knew about. A place in the bushes, or a corner of an attic, or... Well, yes, Sir Cathy, but never like this. When Emile and I were just boys, we must have had a dozen different dens hidden around the shop floor. They still show up from time to time, never where you'd think to look. We had a treehouse, Cathy remembered. Lizzie, that's my sister, used to sneak up cups and saucers and old china. Well, there you have it. And didn't that treehouse seem huge when you were small? It might have been a castle itself when you were 5 years old. You probably thought it had an east and a west wing, different antechambers, a gatehouse and a bailey and a curtain wall. Only, if you went back to it now, you'd find it tiny, just a few lengths of stick and a cramped little cubby. Do you see? Cathy really didn't. That's the secret, I think. Papa won't tell me because he says I'll only really understand if I discover it myself, just like he did. But it's got to be the perspectives. When you're making toys, you've got to have the perspective of a child. Get that right, and I would think you could do almost anything with space. Cathy had finished walking the circumference of the room, and, for the first time, returned to the door where the paper tree sprawled. "We'll just have to wait it out," said Caspar, still hardly masking his glee. "They'll dig us out soon. But..." He paused, for there was a pained expression on Cathy's face. She was cupping her belly with one hand and with the other, bracing herself against the Wendy House wall. "You girl, what's wrong?" She opened her mouth to tell him it was nothing, but when no words came, Caspar was already at her side. "New girl?" He might have been shouting, but to Cathy the voice was as distant as the Emporium doors. "It's nothing," she said, but this time she did not resist as Caspar put an arm around her and helped her into the armchair at the hearth. It had been happening too often. These moments when even the dizziness grew so acute she could feel the Emporium spinning. Normally it was in the mornings when she woke in the small hours and had to creep to the washroom. On those occasions the dizziness could be stifled with tea and dry toast, but more and more often it was coming in the middle of the day. Only yesterday she had been resting in the stacks when Sally Ann had wandered past and made some remark about her shirking. Secrets, it seemed, always wanted to be shared. Caspar had found water from somewhere. She put the mug to her lips and felt rejuvenated, if only for a second. It was only now, when she was at her weakest, that her thoughts flickered back to that little strip along the estuary sands and all the people she had left behind. And is my mother still knotted with fear? She wondered. Is Lizzie worried for me, or does she secretly smile when our parents look the other way? Now that the room had come back into focus, she could see that Caspar was considering her like she was some puzzle he had to unpick. All his glee at the paper forest suddenly drained away. "It's nothing," she promised. "I haven't been eating properly, that's all." Caspar's eyes dropped from her face to her belly before drifting back up. There was no doubt what he was thinking, for Cathy had felt her body straining at her clothes too often in the past days. It was foolish not to have brought more. New life was not the sort of thing you could overlook forever. The baby had been tumbling all day. She could feel it as a new kind of nausea rippling across her insides. "Cathy," he whispered. "How old are you?" "I'm 19, she said, tensing beneath his touch. "You're 16 if you're a day." She held his stare. His eyes had pierced her, but she held it still. "You answered one of Papa's adverts. That means you had to be running away from something. You can't keep a secret in the Emporium, Cathy. Along these aisles a secret's never safe." It seemed important to go on looking into his eyes. They were not eyes you could get lost in. They were open and empty as the oceans, blue threaded with grey like the breakers of waves. The more she stared, the deeper that ocean seemed. And yet she went on staring. He was on the verge of saying something, but she would never know what. For at that moment, the paper trunk blocking the door began to buckle and crease. Caspar leapt to his feet. Without exchanging another word, they watched as the glint of an axe appeared through the bark. It drew back, swung again, and at last the paper monstrosity began to list, revealing the Emporium floor. In the doorway, showered in scraps of paper and card, stood Emile. His eyes were alive with the joy of discovery. "Casper," he said, shaking shreds of paper bark out of his hair, "I just knew it would be you." "Who else?"
"Papa knows it too. He's looking for you."
"I'll bet he is," beamed Casper, and Kathy saw the look they exchanged, the one that said, "There'll be stern words, brother, but every one of them worth it, because just look at all this. Look at all this beautiful chaos."
"You're a bona fide bedlamite," Emil laughed, and with a conspiratorial whisper, "Casper, we should go up high, after hours, up to the highest gallery, and just throw them all down. It would be like that time with Papa's snow clouds. He'll know it was ours, but it'll be..."
Casper was poised to revel in the idea when Emil's face suddenly soured. For the first time he had looked beyond his brother, and there stood Kathy, plain as day and with no place to hide. Suddenly all temptations vanished. Whatever they had been scheming evaporated into thin air.
"It isn't what you think, Emil."
"No?" the younger man breathed. "Then what is it?" Casper marched on, kicking the detritus of paper tree aside, and past Emil. From the aisle he looked back, his eyes taking in Kathy again. Her face, her hair, the curves of her body that she knew for the first time were no longer invisible. He mouthed three words.
"I'll speak soon."
And then he disappeared. Left behind, Emil looked her up and down.
"I'm sorry," he stuttered. "But you really can't be here. If my papa were to..."
He stopped.
"My brother isn't a bad man, but..."
"Back to work," he said, abandoning the thought. "The evening stampede is about to begin." And then he too was gone, leaving Kathy to pick her own way out of the ruin. In the aisles outside, the shopkeepers were already descending on the accidental forest. Some of them had hacksaws and more axes. Some of them had bought shovels to lever up stumps. Yet more had decided to leave a tree in place and were rushing out boxes of baubles and other decorations. Ignoring the complaints of the baby putting up a protest inside her, she rolled up her sleeves and returned to her work. War Games. Papa Jack's Emporium, Christmas, 1906. That moment in the Wendy house had frightened her. She had to admit that. The way Casper Godman had looked at her, not admiringly, not possessively, as those fishermen's sons used to do, but curiously. She had thought she was being careful. At the end of every shift, she took toast and biscuits and stewed apples from Miss Horning's trolley and retired to her room, just her and her baby, to while away the long winter nights. She was keeping her head down, keeping out of sight, keeping herself to herself, and yet... "I'm coiled," she admitted, "coiled too tight. Hiding away doesn't keep you hidden, not in a place like this. Hiding away only gets you seen." "You haven't been thinking straight, little thing. Running away was never just running. It was keeping running. Even when you're standing still. It's all your fault, you know. When I'm not nauseous, I'm dog-tired, and when I'm not dog-tired, I've moods you wouldn't believe. I'm up one minute and rock bottom the next, and it's all your doing." Kathy had found her way through the lower storerooms, where the toys of past Christmases waited patiently to revisit the shop floor. Now she stood outside what seemed a forgotten wardrobe, its door half hanging from its hinge. Sally Ann had tried to tempt her on more than one occasion, but this time it was a little voice inside her head tempting her on. People with secrets hide away. People with nothing to hide. They make friends, they laugh and they dance and they live life. Nobody ever came to the Emporium to bury themselves. So, in plain sight, she whispered, and was thrilled to feel the flutters of her baby's response. That's the only place worth hiding. With those words, she opened the wardrobe door. They called this place the Palace, because that was what Casper and Emil had called it when they were just boys, and this place was one of their secret dens. Now the long hall onto which the wardrobe door opened, decked out like the lodge of some medieval Viking jarl, with thrones carved out of the trunks of great oaks and a dais upon which three of the shop-hands were playing fiddles, or more properly being played by those fiddles, for it was the instruments leading the way, was a retreat for exhausted shop-hands to drink and eat and make merry. Cathy stepped through a fog of smoke to find the evening's banquet already half-devoured. Shop-hands were lounging around the long table, or in the corners playing at cards. Some had opened up copies of other Emporian games. Little Douglas Flood was playing a game of backgammon, himself against the board. The West Country boy named Keezy was battling for a game of chess. Black had already beaten him to a retreat, the pieces gliding of their own volition across the checkerboard squares. Cathy might have let her nerves get the better of her, and fled there and then, if only Sally Ann, tall, with flaming red hair and fiery eyes to match, hadn't appeared out of the haze and thrown her arms around her shoulders. "Rapunzel is out of her tower," she announced. "Make room!" Sally Ann's laughter was infectious. Soon Cathy was being swept across the room and deposited in a seat, where Joe Horner, who worked the production line replicating Emile's toy soldiers, and Ted Jacobs, who once trained hounds for the shooting at Sandringham but now put patchwork dogs through their paces before they could be sold, provided her with food and wine and meringues of the most intricate design. Too used to a diet of toast and stewed apple, the baby inside her started to turn cartwheels of delight. Cathy had to take her first bite just to barter its silence, for she was certain the shop-hands would notice the way her body squirmed in response. "I'm sorry I've been so... locked up. You know how it is, first season nerves." "No apology needed," Sally Ann declared. "But you have catching up to do. This," she declared, urging an older man comprised almost entirely of beard, to the table, "is Pat Field. He's one of Papa Jack's first woodworkers. He prunes and prepares all the logs from the Forestry Commission. And this is Vera Larkin. She's a seamstress, touching up the rag dolls. And this, well, this is Ted. He's with the patchwork dogs." "Blithering things they are as well," Ted said, as around him the rest made their hellos. "It's as well you weren't here last Christmas. Papa Jackie can make almost anything with his hands, but you just can't get loyalty in a patchwork dog." "There were complaints," Sally Ann butted in, as if laying a taunt at Ted. "Little boys upset their new toy would only play with their sister. A patchwork Dalmatian, of all things, who took a shine into some old fella's next-door neighbour and wouldn't stop howling at the walls. Why, 3 Christmases ago, I was up and roaming Battersea on Christmas Eve itself. One of his hounds had gone feral, started running with a pack of street dogs down there." "Ted," Sally Ann interjected once more, "isn't good enough at his job, you see." Ted looked as if he might summon up a spirited reply, but instead he slumped into a seat, pulled the stopper from a decanter of what Cathy took for brandy, and poured himself a generous measure. Moments later, as he stared into the fire, a bundle of velvet and rags unfolded itself from a basket and scrabbled to get into his lap. "And these cats aren't up to much either. How are you finding our little emporium, Cathy?" "Little," she exclaimed. Her eyes had already taken in the extent of the palace. Perhaps she was mistaken, but it seemed another trick of perspective, or whatever it was that opened up the Wendy house down in the paper trees. "Why, I don't think I've seen a fraction of it."
"And you won't," Ted chipped in. "Not this season, at any rate. Midwinter's barely a week away, and how long will we have after that?"
"How long?"
"Until the thaw," Sally Ann explained. "Then it's drawbridge up and our shop-hands out on our ears."
Cathy froze. Even the baby had stopped tumbling inside her. "You don't mean to say..."
"What is it Papa Jack always says? A toy shop's trade is in the dark winter months." "Yes," Sally Ann went on. "He'll be back to the boring life soon. Reckon I'll find myself cleaning dishes in Bethnal Green. Douglas Flood can go back to..." "What is it, Douglas? Understudying at the Old Vic?"
Up on the dais, the boy named Douglas set down his fiddle, though it played on without him, and said,
"Vaudeville. Other mind, I'll chance my arm in the music halls." "Well, you best be taking that fiddle with you. I've heard you try and play a..."
Sally Ann stopped, for a shocking paleness had spread across Cathy's face.
"Cathy, are you all... is it the food?"
"No," she said, "not the food." Though the way her stomach was revolting made her certain she was going to be sick.
If I may, might I be excused?
Excused? Somebody balked. Law, girl, you're not on Mama's table any more.
Just as well, thought Kathy, and reeled as she got to her feet.
Oh, Kathy, come on, you've hardly eaten.
She was unsteady. She caught herself as she made for the wardrobe door. Sally Ann was at her side, but Kathy pulled herself through alone. Halfway through the storeroom, she stopped to catch her breath, looking back to see Sally Ann standing, a question given form, in the wardrobe door. Lives turn on an instant, just as they are made. There was no going back. There never had been. Not since the moment she set foot out of the back door. If there was no staying, if there was no long summer in the Emporium, no place for a mother and child, well, what then?
The approach of Christmas only intensified Kathy's terror of what might happen when the Emporium closed. But the invitation that came on Midwinter's Eve pushed those thoughts to the back of her mind. It had been lying in an envelope slipped beneath the attic door when she returned at the end of the day, and Sally Ann, who had followed her up from the palace, soliloquizing on the Herculean good looks of John Mosby, brought in this winter to wrangle the runnerless rocking horses, was already perched on the end of the bed, pontificating over its contents. There was so little privacy to the room that Kathy could not stop her from seeing. The envelope was sealed with scarlet wax, imprinted with the emblem of Papa Jack's Emporium, a single tin soldier of unquantifiable rank, and inside was a piece of golden card. An invitation to a midwinter's supper. Your confidant, Casper, 9 p.m. Sally Ann was either disgusted or beset with jealousy. Kathy could not tell which. She tossed her hair and leapt to her feet, brandishing one of those romantic penny novels she so loved. He just wants to know what's under your skirts. Well, thought Kathy, that was probably true, but not in the way Sally Ann was thinking. And what was this about confidant? Kathy felt quite certain Casper Godman was not the kind of man who could keep any sort of secret, let alone one as revelatory as this. The clock on the wall was inching towards 8. Kathy folded the invitation and slipped it beneath her pillow. Then, Sally Ann, have you any clothes I can borrow? She asked. The Godmans had quarters on the highest gallery above the shop floor, up a servant stair that spiralled out of their workshops. Winter staff only rarely ventured up here, no matter how long their standing, and, like so many corners of the Emporium, this was virgin ground to Kathy. As it was, the great oaken door that led to Papa Jack's workshop was barricaded shut. Kathy had heard tales of one assistant who had gained a position here only so that he could deliver secrets back to his overseers at Hamley's. The workshop had been a fortress ever since. But the stairs grew out of a narrow passageway just beyond. Kathy was halfway up before she saw the movement on the top step, and watched as something unfolded, sniffed the air and stood up. The dog, she had first seen among the paper trees, lumbered forward on patchwork paws, its stuffing bulging where it had been pressed out of shape while it slept. Its fur was of velvet, cut up by seams as if somebody had taken it apart and stitched it back together. In patches it was grey, in others purple and blue. The insides of its ears were pieces of tartan, and the tongue that lolled from its snout had a heel in it, like a dangling sock. Its nose was nothing more than a crosshatch of black thread. When it realised Kathy was near, it set up a bark. For a moment, Kathy was stilled. Then, judging that what teeth it had were only scraps of felt, she knelt down to pet it. Soon, the creature, if creature it could be called, rolled over, imploring her to knead it back into shape. Unable to refuse the doleful look in its black button eyes, Kathy sank to her haunches and began. Her fingers found the little wind-up mechanism buried in its tummy, and she turned it once, giving the dog even more vigour. After that it lolled in ecstasy, its contented noises like the swishing of cotton against cotton. Finally, Kathy gathered herself and knocked at the door. She was expecting Casper or Emil or Papa Jack himself, but instead Mrs. Hornung opened the door and battled back the patchwork dog with a broom. "Sirius," she exclaimed, "I've a set of shears in here just right for a pest like you." The dog's whimper was the sound of wet laundry being slapped.
Mrs. Hornung had never seemed as sour as she had on the night Kathy arrived at the Emporium doors. The way she looked now, Kathy might even describe her as genial. Her official position was Emporium Mistress, a title that made her seem more matronly than it ought. Sally Ann said she used to be the nursemaid, a job that had been predominantly comprised of tracking Casper and Emil down to whatever hiding place they had made on the Emporium floor and delivering a series of improbable punishments for their cheek. She had even been the one to teach them the King's English, but whatever they had done had aged her prematurely. Their misadventures could be read in the wrinkles latticing her face. Now that the Godman brothers were grown, her role had transformed. A better title might have been Emporium Housekeeper, responsible for making sure the shop assistants were watered and fed. "I'll help you off with those. These carpets are a nightmare to clean." Kathy had to brace herself as Mrs. Hornung levered off her shoes. Then she was ushered onwards into a palatial hall where glass capsules set between the rafters revealed snow clouds strewn across the London sky. Steps couched in thick burgundy dropped into a living room bedecked in Emporium instant trees, colourful streamers hanging around each. A huge hearth dominated half of the room, flames licking high into the chimney, and on a raised level close to the door a table was already laid for supper. Somewhere a piano was playing a concerto to itself, ebony and ivory rippling up and down without the touch of human hands. Mrs. Hornung meant to whisk her on, but the carpeted expanse in the middle of the room was occupied by 100 toy soldiers. Some of them were in static regiments on the fringes of the carpet, but others were either marching at each other with rifles raised or lying prostrate on the ground. On one side of the room, Emil was hunched over a regiment, winding them up madly. On the opposite side, Casper was mirroring the action, but spreading his soldiers along a much vaster front. As Mrs. Hornung hopped through, her foot caught one of the marching soldiers, knocking him back into his brethren. "Forfeit," Emil piped up, leaping to his feet. "I call it null and void." "Act of God," Casper announced. "We've accounted for them before." "Act of God? It's outside the rules of the game." "It's warfare, little brother. There are no rules." "That's demonstrably untrue. Don't you remember your Deuteronomy?" Casper grinned. "You'd do better to remember your Sun Tzu." Just as the battle seemed about to escalate from the minions on the carpet to the deities above it, Mrs. Hornung returned, and beside her, Papa Jack. Kathy had only rarely seen him since that first night. The toymaker, Sally Ann said, stayed in his natural habitat, and that was his workshop. He was holding himself on 2 wooden canes, their bulbs carved into the visages of bears, and looked even more mountainous like this than he had in his workshop chair. His hair was a waterfall frozen over the crags of his body. "Let there be an armistice," he announced, with a voice full of whispers. "Boys, your guest has arrived." Casper's eyes had already found her, but it took some time before Emil could tear himself away from the calamity on the battlefield. Whatever had happened here was so unjust he had tears pricking in his eyes. Him, an 18-year-old man, crying over toy soldiers. "This doesn't count, Casper." "We'll talk it through later, little brother." "I tell you, it doesn't count!" Casper met Kathy on the step. "You came," he said, taking her hand. "I did. I wondered whether you might have another engagement." He was needling at her, but with what purpose Kathy was not sure. "When your employers invite you to dinner," she began, "it's customary to accept." "I'm glad that you did. When 2 people have been in true danger as we have, it engenders a bond." He paused. "Hungry, are you?" Perhaps that was it, Kathy thought. Perhaps he was trying to catch her out somehow, trying to trick her into revealing her secret. His eyes had not lingered on her bump yet, but the night was young. Why was he still holding onto her hand? "Dinner is served," came Papa Jack's fraying voice, and at once Casper took her to the table. It was not food Kathy had ever imagined before, though she was no less grateful for that. Mrs. Hornung had spent years perfecting the dishes of the old country, Casper explained, putting a particular emphasis on the word so that it seemed to Kathy to be some fairy kingdom not quite real. The dumplings were called Varenicki. The gingerbreads had a warmth she was not expecting. The soup was of beetroot and to be eaten cold, alongside slabs of dark rye bread. She started tentatively, but soon the baby was demanding more. "So," said Caspar, "you are hungry, after all." At the head of the table, Papa Jack laid down his spoon. "I think what my firstborn means to say, Miss Ray, is that he apologizes earnestly for jeopardizing your safety as he did the other day. Caspar, have you anything to add?"
"Papa, I've explained. Miss Ray was positively thrilled to see the paper forest, and so were the customers. Do you know how many Emporium Instant Trees we sold last week?"
Papa Jack returned to his food.
"All of them."
It was true. Kathy had sold many of them herself in her first afternoons working the register. Caspar had put two of the Emporium's most trusted shop hands onto night shift so that more could be made, but no sooner did they go onto the shop floor than they were taken again. Somebody, some duchess or minor baronet, was reputed to have lain a forest of them in her hall for the village children to explore. Somebody else had thought to line the trails of Regent's Park.
"Nevertheless," said Papa Jack, and for the first time his eyes fell entirely on Kathy, "you came to the shop not only as our assistant, but as our guest. There are laws of hospitality we would be fools to overlook. We are supposed to honour those responsibilities, aren't we, boy?"
Caspar lifted his eyes to meet hers.
"My apologies given, Miss Ray."
"And accepted," said Kathy, though the whole thing seemed preposterous.
"I hope it has not diminished what you think of us. Tell me, what do you make of our little emporium?"
There were too many traps in this conversation, and it was too difficult to know which ones were being knowingly laid. So, honesty being the best policy, Kathy said, "I don't want to leave."
"There are some weeks yet before winter's end. You may think differently before then."
He was making a joke, of sorts, and Kathy found that she didn't have to force a smile. Papa Jack's voice was as placid as the snowfall she could now see plastering itself against the window panes beyond the paper trees. High above London, the clouds were giving up their gifts, decorating the rooftops in white. What would it be like to be tramping those streets now, the baby swaddled up against her breast? "Do you really open at first frost and close when the snowdrops flower?"
"Every year," said Papa Jack. "A toy shop's trade is in the dark winter months, Miss Ray. It's only then the magic can truly be conjured. Our summers are given over to creating. The Emporium would not be what it is today were it not for those months. Yes, while the rest of the world is out there lounging in the long grass, the three of us are here in our workshops waiting for winter." He made them sound like a family of bears. And now that she thought of it, there was something peculiarly ursine about Papa Jack. Emil had something of the same look about him. She looked his way and found him with his head down, concentrating on dinner. Surely he couldn't still be brooding on whatever game they had been playing as she walked in. Her eyes danced across the table and found Caspar and said, "This summer was when I made my trees," he said. "The dirigibles, too. Somewhere, out there, there's a family floating in one of my dirigibles through a forest of paper trees. Tell me, can you think of anything more perfect?" He stopped and turned on Emil. "Emil, what did you make this summer?"
"You know what I made, Caspar."
"Tell Miss Ray, Emil, there's no need to be ashamed."
Pointedly, Emil dropped his fork. "I'm not ashamed."
"Good, because there's really no need to be. Your birds are something quite special. The way they explode and flutter up, you'd think they were almost real. And remember last year? What was it? Your picnic hampers, yes. You'd really believe you were in a park on a lazy summer's day. Did we ever go through the ledges for them, little brother? Did we see how they sold? Only, I don't see the hampers on the shelves this year, and there are still so many boxes of birds in the storerooms, I wonder if we ought to be letting them go out into the wild. You never know, it might draw some customers in, to see your pipe-cleaner birds in Hyde Park. A spectacle like that, just think of what it did for my trees."
Kathy had thought Emil had the same ursine look as his father, and it intensified now.
Every muscle of his face tightened as if preparing to snarl. Then, quashing whatever had been bubbling up inside him, he stood up. You'd do well to pay attention to the ledgers, Caspar. It might be your trees, Papa's patchwork dogs they write about in the Chronicle.